You're listening to episode number 8 of The Green Elephant in the Room.
Welcome to The Green Elephant in the Room, conversations about the climate and environment. Now here is your host, Rico.
This is your host, Rico, at The Green Elephant in the Room. We're coming to you from beautiful Guadalajara, Mexico, where each week we address issues concerning the environment and climate change and give you timely tips, insights, and inspiration for all of us to live a cleaner, affordable, and more fulfilling lives while easing the burden that we are putting on the Earth's living ecosystems. I'm going to share something with you that may come as a surprise. Climate change is not our biggest environmental problem. This show is called The Green Elephant in the Room, and the subtitle is Conversations About Climate and the Environment. The environment. Obviously, climate change is epic. It is so grand and so commanding. Ironically, it's easy to overlook in our everyday lives. And, as you know, scientists tell us that the impact of climate change will be with us for decades and centuries and needs to be dealt with now to avoid the worst impacts in the future. The fact is, no matter what we do, some global warming is coming for us, but we can still prevent the worst of it. However, there are a number of environmental challenges which require solutions right now and have the potential to cause much more immediate harm than global warming. There are extensive impacts on the land and in the air and the waters of the earth that are not related to climate change. Nevertheless, in recent decades, as climate change has come to dominate environmental concerns, there has been a significant shift in the discussion. Today, most environmental reporting is focused laser-like on climate change, and those other worsening ecological dilemmas are seldom publicized. They don't get a lot of attention. What's interesting is that climate change has been around as a concept for about 100 years. But it wasn't until 1988 when it came into the public's consciousness. It was 30 years ago that James Hansen, then NASA's top climate scientist, testified to Congress about the dangers of human-caused climate change. 1988. The first Earth Day was in 1970. So if climate change awareness wasn't until 18 years after the first Earth Day, what were we so worked up about? The four pillars of environmental concern are air pollution, water pollution, and habitat destruction. And now, climate change. Our biggest problem at this moment is not climate change. It is not peak oil. It is not overpopulation or resource depletion. Instead, it is our inability to understand an unwillingness to accept the long-range implications of the global impact of humanity on the ecosystems of the world. Let's be clear. The biggest immediate environmental crisis we face today is not climate change. It is the loss of habitat, which leads to the loss of biodiversity. Habitat is where plants and animals live. I'm sure you've heard the term before, biodiversity. What does it mean? Biological diversity. Bio means life. It is the variety of life on Earth in all its forms and all its interactions. If that sounds bewilderingly complex, that's because it is. Biodiversity is the most comprehensive feature of life on our planet, and it is the most vital. Biodiversity represents the knowledge learned by species including humans, about how to survive on Earth over millions of years of evolution. If undamaged, this produces a finely balanced, thriving system which contributes to the health of a sustainable planet. Let's keep it simple. The air you breathe, the water you drink, and the food you eat all rely on biodiversity. But right now, it is in crisis because of habitat loss. Human destruction of nature is rapidly grinding down the world's capacity to provide food, water, and security to billions of people. Without biodiversity, there is no future for humanity. Earth is home to millions of species, but just one dominates: us. We are very clever creatures, and our inventiveness and our activities have modified almost every part of our planet. And because of that, we are having a profound impact on it. In fact, that cleverness, that inventiveness, and our activities are now drivers of every global problem we face. And every one of those problems is accelerating as we continue to grow towards a global population of 10 billion. And it is undeniable that we can rightly call the situation we're in right now an emergency, an unprecedented planetary emergency. So, what's the problem? And what are the greatest threats to the bountiful foundation of life on Earth today? They are the same threats that have been with us since we first industrialized 200 years ago. Guns, fishing nets, chainsaws, and bulldozers. Think about that short list. They are the things that kill plants and animals or destroy their habitat. Guns, fishing nets, chainsaws, and bulldozers. Measuring the impacts of climate change is incredibly difficult. All the interactions with humans and the atmosphere and the oceans. Lots of science there. On the other hand, measuring habitat loss can be calculated very easy. Habitat loss can be seen with your own eyes. You can see the farm field that was once a forest. You can see the parking lot that was once a wetland. You can clearly see the giant suburban housing development that was once pristine habitat for plants and wildlife. Even things that you don't normally see have an impact, like massive clear cuts in remote forest or enormous oil fields that exist far away from populated areas or out at sea. Some scientists that are studying these issues are calling this massive loss of wildlife a biological annihilation. And they say it's representing a frightening assault on the foundations of human civilization. So, could the loss of biodiversity be a greater threat to humanity than climate change? The answer is yes. Nothing on Earth is experiencing more dramatic change at the hands of human activity. Think about this. Changes to the climate are reversible, even if that takes centuries or millennia. But once species become extinct, there's no going back. The indisputable way to stop biodiversity loss is to preserve habitat and stop deforestation and habitat destruction. Here's an astonishing factoid to give you some perspective. By weight, 97% of the world's vertebrate land animals are human or their livestock. Just 3% are thought to be wild. Here's another amazing fact. Preserving habitat from deforestation would also be the most effective way of combating climate change. By protecting habitat, we are essentially working toward two goals. Number one, climate change mitigation. Mitigation means to lessen the impact. And the second goal is the preservation of vital ecosystems. If we could recognize the inseparable connections of all of our ecological crises, if we could successfully address this one make-or-break environmental crisis, we will be able to buy time to deal with the other ones waiting in the wings, such as air and water pollution, overpopulation, species extinction, resource depletion, and climate change. The bottom line is, protecting biodiversity is as important as fighting climate change. So, how do we do this? Pulitzer Prize-winning author and world-renowned biologist E.O. Wilson says that in order to prevent the mass extinction of species, we need a solution that is proportionate with the magnitude of the problem. In his book, Half Earth, he gives us a visionary and concrete proposal to dedicate fully half of the Earth to nature. He identifies actual regions of the planet that can still be reclaimed, such as the California Redwood Forest, the Amazon River Basin, and the grasslands of the Serengeti, among others. Does that sound too radical? Really? What is radical is that we are wasting away the planet's living ecosystems. What is radical is that the world currently only protects 15% of the land and 7% of the oceans. What is radical is the prevailing pessimism of our time. We need ambitious and aggressive action to avert the wanton destruction of our biosphere. We are going to have to step up and be the heroes and provide the leadership necessary not to risk the stability of our planet today and for all future generations. So, for the environmental issues that I'm discussing here, what is climate change and what is not? Keep in mind that habitat loss and biodiversity and climate change do cross-pollinate in some cases. For example, if you whack down a forest, you no longer have the benefit of those trees sucking up excess carbon. But the actual clear cutting of a forest is not climate change. The cutting of the forest is first and foremost habitat destruction, which leads to loss of biodiversity. There are many eco-ills that are not climate change. Let's play a game. Is it climate change or is it not climate change? Let's start with the country-sized patches of plastic garbage floating in all the world's oceans. Now, of course, plastic is a petroleum product, but it is not climate change. You want to hear something amazing? 93% of all the plastic in the oceans comes from just 10 rivers, and 8 of those rivers are in Asia. Just 10 rivers carry over 90% of the plastic that ends up in the oceans. Those rivers include the Indus, the Yellow, Ganges, and Mekong. 2, the Nile and the Niger, are in Africa. The rivers all have 2 things in common: a generally high population living in the surrounding region, sometimes into the hundreds of millions of people, and because of extreme poverty, there is no effective waste management process. And the number one river in that group is the Yangtze River, which is Asia's longest river. The Yangtze River Basin is home to almost 500 million people, which is more than one-third of China's population. It is also the biggest carrier of plastic pollution to the oceans. To its credit, China recently has made efforts to curb waste. If you listen to our report on recycling, you have learned that for years the country had imported millions of tons of recyclable waste from overseas. But a growing recycling burden at home prompted the Chinese government to shift its policy. An important thing to remember, the majority of that plastic imported to China has come from Europe and the U.S. And so a lot of that plastic flowing into and infesting the world's oceans comes from us. And you thought we were off the hook. Here's an ingenious idea to deal with the problem: the plastic bank. The plastic bank is a chain of stores for the ultra poor, where everything can be purchased by plastic garbage by weight. Everything means that the most important things like school tuition, or access to medical care, sustainable cooking fuels, Wi-Fi, cell phone minutes, everything the world's poor needs and can't often afford is now available using plastic garbage. Plastic garbage is acting as a currency. This program has the dual purpose of stopping more plastic from flowing into the oceans and helping people in need at the same time. The plastic is cleaned, graded, bundled, and shipped to companies who manufacture things like shampoo and household cleaners, where the plastic is reused. This is the kind of innovative ideas that we need for the 21st century. Next up, dams on rivers. Are they climate change or not? This one's a little trickier. There are 48,000 river dams in the world. The United States has well over 9,000 dams, second only to China, which has a staggering 24,000 dams. Between those two countries, they have almost 70% of the world's dams. Dams are one of those things that intersect both the changes in climate and the impacts on habitat. Yes, they do provide green, clean energy, but that comes at a huge cost. Unfortunately, they also worsen the impact of climate change. Often forests are leveled to make way for the dam and its reservoir. They also release greenhouse gases, destroy carbon sinks in wetlands and oceans, deprive ecosystems of nutrients, destroy habitats, wastewater, and displace millions of poor communities. Clean, free-flowing rivers are the veins and arteries of our country. Rivers are the original infrastructure. Healthy rivers are our natural defense against global warming impacts. Free-flowing rivers give us clean water and natural flood protection, benefits that we will need in combating future warming. Likewise, fish and wildlife will need healthy rivers more than ever if they are going to survive in a warming world. There are a couple of solutions. The first is to realize that dams are so disruptive and destructive to ecosystems, even with the benefits of green energy, that we should not build anymore. The second most promising solution is dam removal. Obviously, we are not going to knock down all of the dams, but many dams are outdated or unsafe. We need to recognize that dams have finite lifespans. Rivers are dynamic, and when a dam becomes obsolete and is removed, it is amazing how quickly a vibrant, healthy river ecosystem can return. 2017 was a record year with 87 dams removed and their rivers restored. Fresh water is vital to the functioning of the Earth's hydrological cycle and maintenance of aquatic and surrounding ecosystems and the support of human life. Preserving healthy and high-functioning waterways contributes to controlling global temperatures and sustaining freshwater reserves, among countless other benefits. So, are river dams climate change or not? I would say that they contribute less to climate change and more to habitat destruction. Here's an example that highlights what a problem poaching is. Poaching is the illegal trapping and killing of wildlife. In Cambodia, forest rangers found over 100,000 snares in a single park in that country. Snares, either metal or rope that trap animals, are indiscriminately killing wildlife across Southeast Asia. A simple brake cable for a motorbike can kill a tiger, a bear, even a young elephant in Southeast Asia. The problem has become so bad that scientists are referring to the protected areas in the region as empty forest. One researcher said that some forests in Vietnam don't have any mammals left larger than squirrels. That is not climate change. The poaching of animals, the illegal killing of wildlife, globally is a multi-billion dollar business that is only third behind unlawful drug and weapon sales. What are the best ways to stop poaching? One of the most effective ways is to stop demand. A hopeful example is almost total domestic bans on ivory trade announced by the two biggest world markets for ivory, the United States and China. Another promising method of stopping this criminal and environmentally devastating practice is technology. One wildlife park in South Africa is equipping its rangers with drones, thermal cameras, and trackers that are attached to every car that enters, and magnetic sensors that can detect guns that are being smuggled in. What can you do? Don't buy animal products. Listen to episode number 6 of The Green Elephant on travel and tourism for more insights. The disastrous practice of poaching, climate change? No, it's not. How about invasive species? As human beings have increased traveling and trade all around the world, many species of organisms have been transported to areas that they never would have been able to access in the past. Many exotic species have become invasive around the world, resulting in a great deal of an environmental and economic damage. Invasives are particularly devastating on islands. I am sure many of you have been to Hawaii. Half the plants you see on the islands are not native. They are alien species. I was in Hawaii years ago, and at the start of a hiking trail, there was actually a heavy-duty doormat for you to wipe your feet so you could avoid bringing in any seeds, thistles, stickers, or other outsiders hitchhiking on your shoes. The best way to fight invasive species is to prevent them from occurring in the first place. Things that seem as innocent as buying plants for your garden, boating in different bodies of water, or transporting firewood can introduce and spread invasive species. Check my website for more insights and tips. Are invasive species associated with climate change? Because of changing conditions and temperatures, there may be some instances, but generally, no. Have you ever heard of marine dead zones? Sounds appealing, no? Virtually all of the chemical fertilizers we put on our crops are made from petroleum. That's right, we are pouring oil on our farms. Crops need nitrogen and phosphorus, and we have learned how to make them from fossil fuels. The problem is rains wash off this excess chemical fertilizer, and they eventually find their way into our seas and oceans. All these nutrients create massive algae blooms, which create a kind of toxic environment and choke oxygen from the water. And yes, sea creatures breathe oxygen in the water from their gills. You end up with mass fish die-offs and mass turtle die-offs. This ends up reducing our seas and oceans to lifeless underwater deserts. At last count, there were 146 dead zones in the world's oceans. And the biggest marine dead zone in the world? It's in the Gulf of Mexico. The world's biggest dead zone stretches from the Mississippi River Delta in Louisiana westward to the Texas coast. It covers almost 9,000 square miles, an area the size of New Jersey. They have been monitoring this particular dead zone for 32 years, And the sad fact is that last year they discovered it was the largest it has ever been. Now, here's an important fact. Just because it's the biggest dead zone ever recorded, we should not lose hope. We should still work together to reduce nutrient runoff. Some promising programs are working with farmers to identify and target farms with the highest incidences of runoff, rather than just randomly reducing phosphorus throughout a watershed. These will result in cleaner water. Another science-based solution to nutrient runoff is to restore floodplains, which can slow the flow of the water, naturally capturing the nutrients that would otherwise drift downstream. And again, on our website, we have some suggestions how you, a homeowner, can ease this problem. So, are all chemical fertilizers causing these massive dead zones associated with climate change? No climate change there. What about the record wildfires being experienced in the western United States and in other countries? Here is something that is not just climate change. Human activity is a major factor in driving wildfires. And you thought it was drought. And how do those pesky humans manage to make those fires worse? A century of fire suppression left a lot of stuff to burn. Then we plop housing developments all over these forested areas, which gives us more opportunity to start fires. It might surprise you, but humans are responsible for igniting more than 90% of the wildfires in the West. Most fires are accidental, but still, there are a lot more people living in these forested areas, so there is a lot more opportunity for accidents. What can be done? We need to rethink forest fires. We need to rethink how we manage forest. Forests have been managing themselves for hundreds of thousands of years. It has only been in the last 100 years or so that we have thrown things out of balance and are experiencing these massive conflagrations that burn so hot they sterilize the soil. There can be no blueprint to managing harmful forest fires and fire risks to people and ecosystems. Each situation has its own ecological, social, economic, and political circumstances that need to be evaluated. Still, many governments continue to pursue a one-size-fits-all strategy that places undue emphasis on fighting forest fires through advanced technologies. One of the most effective ways of dealing with this issue are what are called prescribed burns. Forests naturally have had fires for thousands of years, and we have come in the last 100 years or so and simply stopped fires. And because of that, we now have a huge fuel load that has built up over time. Prescribed burns would mimic the natural processes that have always happened in forests. The problem? So many people now live in these forested areas, they don't want to deal with the potential danger or the smoke. This is where governments, industry, and other land managers are going to have to come together and work with communities to come up with plans to deal with these issues. So while it is true that climate change is causing more droughts, which exacerbates these fires, it is human intervention that has caused these problems, and it is human intervention that will solve them. I had many other environmental ills that are not related to climate change that I was going to speak about, but I'm running out of time. I'll list just a few. For example, lead-acid batteries. If you own a car, you own a lead-acid battery. If you own an electric car, you probably own a series of lead-acid batteries. The key word here, of course, is lead. It's massively toxic to animals and to plants. Remember, I'm not just talking about you or the United States. I'm talking about the billion-plus cars, trucks, and motorcycles worldwide that all have a lead-acid battery. They can be recycled, but many are not. How about wastewater and untreated sewage that pours into our bays and seas and oceans? That is not climate change. How about urban sprawl? Every building, even the good ones like schools and hospitals, every structure is sitting on what was once pristine wildlife habitat. And then there's the real biggie when it comes to habitat loss and the loss of biodiversity, agriculture. All of those farmlands you see represent the disappearance of habitat. In the 1970s, farmers were encouraged to plant fence post to fence post. In the past, native plants and little creatures could live on the margins of farms. Not anymore. Fence post to fence post. Maximize output. Maximize profits. If you listen to my third podcast, I addressed agriculture in relation to the meat and dairy industry. There you heard that the majority of our farmland is used to produce animal feed. When was the last time you ate hay? Is alfalfa a big part of your diet? Do you eat corn? A few ears of sweet corn on the cob in the summer? Maybe some corn chips? That is a tiny fraction of the corn we eat, unless you're eating corn-fed beef. Agriculture has the largest environmental footprints of all human activities on our planet today, composing almost half of all land use and by far the majority of fresh water usage. With all the food we raise for ourselves, the food we raise for animals we eat, global commercial agriculture is the most destructive force on the planet. Some aspects of big ag contribute to climate change, but the majority of the impacts are not climate change. Let's be clear. The biodiversity crisis, which is the rapid loss of species and the rapid wearing down of our ecosystems, is probably a greater threat than global climate change to the stability and future of life on Earth as we know it. There is a need for scientists, politicians, and government authorities, corporations, and us as individuals to closely collaborate if we are going to solve this crisis. There are reasons to be optimistic. We have begun a great transition toward sustainable living. Now we need to focus on the scale and speed of this transition if we are going to separate economic development from environmental decline. But there is a long way to go. While climate change has entered the mainstream of political thinking, biodiversity is largely being ignored. We need to make biodiversity loss and nature loss a serious issue, an issue that people are afraid of. We are scared of climate change, but the loss of nature is even more scary. The concept of biodiversity is too remote, too esoteric, too intangible. People don't connect, and yet people are sad when they hear about extinctions or the decline of animal populations or deforestation, but they don't appear to be worried. The reason for this decline is that for the most of 2 million years that humankind has been around, we've taken nature for granted. Fruits were there to be picked, fish to be fished, game to be hunted. It's only been in the last 50 or 60 years, because of population growth and technology, we've realized that these resources are not infinite. Using them up will massively affect economic and social stability. Only a few generations ago, the world was overwhelmed with animal and plant life. Giant flocks of birds filled our skies. Massive schools of fish populated our oceans. No more. Humanity has wiped out 60% of mammals, birds, fish, and reptiles since 1970. I will repeat that. 60% of all vertebrate animals, creatures with backbones, have either been killed or annihilated because of habitat destruction. Think about that for a moment. This huge and shocking loss is a tragedy in itself, but it also threatens the survival of our human civilization. The world is losing species at a rate that is 100 to 1,000 times faster than the natural extinction rate. We're only seeing an abundance of wildlife in our nature reserves. Outside of that, there is very little native wildlife left. Nature reserves are becoming like natural art installations, little boutiques where we can visit wildlife like you might go to a museum. You know what we need? We need a peaceful public uprising. We need people to say, we've had enough. We do that every time there's a terror attack. We need a similar movement for nature. We need people to stand up and say, we want action now. We have the ability to fix this ecological apocalypse of our creation. If we lose the oxygen that comes from the ocean and the clean water that comes from forests, then we're really doomed. Without more pressure from civil society, that's me and you, the media, and voters, governments have been reluctant to sacrifice short-term economic goals to meet the longer term of environmental challenge to human well-being. Preserving habitat from deforestation would also be the most effective way of combating climate change. By protecting habitat, we are essentially working toward two goals: reducing climate change and the preservation of vital ecosystems.
Thanks for listening to The Green Elephant. Visit us on our website, bit.ly/greenelephantintheroom. That's bit.ly/greenelephantintheroom, where you can find valuable information and links to everything that was addressed on today's show and more.
Next week on The Green Elephant in the Room, we're going to answer the question, do we live better than kings and queens of old? If His Majesty and Her Highness tune in next week, they will find out.